Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden withholds weapons from Israel and threatens a broader arms embargo if the Israeli government moves into Rafah, the last stronghold of Hamas in Gaza. We'll talk about the strategic and political implications of this very big decision to draw a red line around the war-fighting decisions by an ally. Plus, Marjorie Taylor Greene fails to take down Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. Is this the end of the Republican dysfunction in the House? Or merely a respite between chaos moments? Welcome, I'm Paul Gigot, the editorial page editor of the Wall Street Journal, here on our opinion podcast, Potomac Watch, where we're here every day. I'm here with Elliot Kaufman and Kate Batchelder Odell. And let's start with President Biden telling CNN, confirming on Wednesday what the press had been reporting for several days, which is that he's withholding weapons from Israel as a warning not to move into the city of Rafah to clear Hamas from Gaza, and that the president will impose a broader ban on weapons if Israel defies him. In other words, he's setting out a red line for an ally of the kind that, well, he hasn't imposed on adversaries. Let's listen to the president explain his decision.
Civilians have been killed in Gaza as a consequence of those bombs and other ways in which they go after population centers. And I made it clear that if they go into Rafah, they haven't gone into Rafah yet. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with the cities, to deal with that problem. We're going to continue to make sure Israel is secure in terms of Iron Dome and their ability to respond to attacks like came out of the in the Middle East recently. But it's just wrong. We're not going to supply the weapons and the artillery shells used.
Wow. Big decision and a shift of policy, Elliot, by the president, who said in the wake of the October 7th massacre that Hamas would have to be destroyed, much like ISIS. He endorsed that policy. But the practical ramifications of not going into Rafah, which is believed to be the last holdout of at least something like four battalions of Hamas's fighters, that Hamas will survive in Gaza. Is that an overreaction on my part?
I don't think it is. I mean, when you hear his statement that it would be wrong to fight in Rafah, the population centers, you have to wonder, was it wrong to fight in Gaza City? Was it wrong to fight in Khan Yunus? Was it wrong to fight ISIS in Mosul? I mean, when you have a terrorist group that is in control of territory and is operating in a city and using human shields, is the president's belief that that gives it immunity all of a sudden? Or is that only for Israel right now when it has become a political issue for the president? And if the objective remains defeating Hamas, I don't see how the terrorist group can be allowed to rule territory, how it can be allowed to have its southern stronghold that connects it to various smuggling routes in Egypt, that houses its leaders, hostages, and like you said, four military battalions. The objective of the war, that's what is at stake right here.
Kate, let's go through some of the weapons that the press reports he is withholding. One notable weapon is these JDAM kits, which allow for precise bombs, that is to narrow the targeting window so that you do less damage to civilians.
Right. So those are kits that you attach to different types of bombs, and the publicly available data on how accurate they are within 3 meters. That is essential to any kind of urban warfare where you are trying to minimize collateral damage to civilians. I'd say the same thing about precision-guided 155 shells that are also far more precise than the unguided varieties that we have in larger quantities. So I do think in an alternate universe, the president would be explaining to the public why U.S. involvement and U.S. arms supply for Israel is a force for minimizing civilian casualties and damage to civilians in this war. And we also, the U.S. military has a lot of experience, as Elliot was alluding to, in fighting this kind of urban warfare in Fallujah particularly, and could be helpful in helping the Israelis make these targeting choices and finding good enough intelligence to make sure that they are behaving with a precise and with as much regard to civilian damage as possible. So again, it is really breathtaking to see the president basically hold up all different types of weapons for Israel. And I think it's really important to underscore that the net effect of that will be to make what Israel has to do more damaging and more bloody.
Also, I guess, you know, the president explained it and said, we'll still give Israel the weapons it needs for the Iron Dome. And that's a ground-to-air and anti-missile defenses. And that's good. But he says that will make them secure. But how can Israel be secure if Hamas survives in Gaza? We saw what happened on October 7th. And then how can Israel be secure if it cannot get the weapons it might need in a conflict which could open up any day, really, from the north by Hezbollah, which has all of those rockets and missiles? And we saw only less than a month ago a direct attack from Iran. Now the U.S. helped stop that, and there was little damage in Israel. But if the U.S. wouldn't do that, that would be potentially catastrophic for Israel.
Yes. And of course, a great deal of the way that Israel defends itself against these sorts of threats is in its ability to respond to them. And so I think saying that the U.S. will help defend Israel but won't provide any offensive weapons actually doesn't make sense in that way. Because if Israel can't respond offensively after it has been attacked by Hezbollah, Iran, any of the other Iranian proxy organizations that are currently firing on Israel on six fronts, what defense is that really? I think Israel is being put in real danger here. I mean, we're in the middle of a hot war. Hezbollah has a massive arsenal, and even by using only a small fraction of it, it has been able to depopulate the north of Israel for 7 months and counting. What if it uses more of that arsenal? Israel needs weapons here to defend itself, to restore its country. I think cutting off arms like this is provocative. It's an invitation to Israel's enemies.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have more on this momentous decision by the president to impose essentially an arms embargo on Israel when we come back.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
That dog does not want to be petted.
Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here on Potomac Watch with Kate Batchelder Odell and Elliot Kaufman. We're talking about the president's decision to withhold weapons from Israel. And I think one of the questions politically is why. Okay, why is he doing this now? It's an abrupt change in policy. His justification for it, as we heard earlier, is that he wants to reduce civilian casualties. We've explained that U.S. weapons actually help reduce civilian casualties. He clearly wants to stop the entire Rafah operation. And this strikes me as a response politically to the pressure he's been having inside the United States and inside his own party against Israel's war here. What is your view? Why is he doing this?
I mean, I think that's the answer, is that he's been basically bowing to this fraction of the progressive left. And I would note the overwhelming votes that we had in Congress quite recently on U.S. aid for Israel, I think, should have ended that argument. Anybody in Congress had the opportunity to make their argument about why we shouldn't support Israel. And both chambers rejected it pretty soundly, of more than 300 votes in the House for that final bill.
Just if I can elaborate on that, Kate, 366 to 58 in the House and 79 to 18 in the Senate, majorities in both parties in favor of delivering those weapons to Israel.
Well, I think that should give the president a pretty big indicator about what the politics of supporting Israel are. So it is odd that the progressive left has this veto, even so, after such a broad show of support. I do think it's going to backfire on the president. I do not think he's going to be able to hold this untenable stance of denying them weapons, so largely for the reasons Elliot was describing about how provocative it is. I do think, given how many weapons we've transferred to Israel, that they won't have an immediate ammunition shortage for the operation in Rafah. But Hezbollah in the north is a completely different story, a better equipped force. They could need to strike hundreds or thousands of targets per day if something were to pop off there. And we're basically telling Hezbollah that we're going to hold back ammo from Israel. So I don't think the president will be able to sustain it. And that's just going to make the politics even worse for him.
Let's listen to Speaker of the House Mike Johnson as he expresses his view about the president's decision. It's an illustration of firm opposition.
He's defying the will of Congress, and he's defying what his own top officials in the White House assured me in writing and verbally before that supplemental was passed and even in the days since. This idea of withholding weapons to Israel as a condition of somehow, you know, Joe Biden wanted to micromanage their war effort over there, their defensive effort, is catastrophic policy. It would be devastating to our closest ally in the region, and it would go directly against the will of what the members of this body voted on just several days ago. So they have got to answer to the American people and answer to us, and we're on that right now.
There you have it. And that opposition from Speaker Johnson has been joined by many voices in the Republican Party, less vociferously in the Democratic Party so far, as you would expect with a Democratic president, although John Fetterman, the Pennsylvania senator, did express his opposition. Elliot, I wonder the calculation here, politically and geostrategically, by the president isn't just a function of left in the United States, but it demonstrates the president really wants this war over ASAP. And he wants Israel, therefore, not to go into Rafah because he hopes he can get a ceasefire, get an exchange of hostages. And even if it's said to be a temporary ceasefire, he wants this to evolve into a permanent ceasefire, which will then allow temperatures in the U.S. politically to die down, he hopes, and then to be able to strike a peace deal and strategic cooperation agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia, which includes security guarantees by the United States for the Saudis, as well as some commercial nuclear technology transfer. And I think that's the big game here. He wants that to be able to get done. A lot of work has been done on it behind the scenes, but he wants that deal that he can tout as a great foreign policy success.
He wants that deal, and he wants this over so that he can get to that deal. The problem that the Biden policy has run into again and again is that they're trying to end the war the wrong way. They think they can get the Israelis to just, okay, we can live with Hamas on our borders. It'll regroup. It'll take over the rest of Gaza again, and it'll try to plan October 7th once again. But
we can deter that.
If we can just pressure Israel enough, we can make them live with that. So far, it hasn't worked, and I don't think it's going to work going forward. The way to end this war has always been through a speedy Israeli victory. Instead, every step of the way, Biden policy has ended up dragging out this war, slowing down Israel's military operation. We're seeing that once again right here. I think Israel is going to have to proceed in a slower way, the Rafah operation, parts of it may go through, parts of it not. We're going to see more fighting, exactly what the Biden administration doesn't want. The one thing, by the way, it hasn't done is allow there to be more pressure on Hamas. Hamas has resisted the kind of hostage deal that might bring this to an end because it hasn't had to negotiate under fire. Biden keeps on holding back Israel. Hamas takes advantage.
All right, we're going to take another break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the attempted coup against House Speaker Mike Johnson and why it failed when we come back.
There's a new class of blockbuster drugs, drugs like Ozempic. They're changing bodies.
And all of a sudden, just the weight starts falling off.
Fortunes.
It just got too expensive.
They're just bank breakers.
And industries.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of skepticism.
The impact of these drugs from business to health is just beginning.
From the Journal, Trillion Dollar Shot. Find it in the Journal feed wherever you get your podcasts.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker. Play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal, here with Elliot Kaufman and Kate Batchelder Odell. And just one, Kate, on the arms embargo by Biden on Israel. That concerns what Congress can do about it. Can they do much? Probably not.
Well, there is outrage in Congress that I think Mike Johnson captured pretty well. And keep in mind that some Democrats took what they perceived to be political risk to vote for that bill. And then to find out that the president has no intention of offering the weapons is a slap in the face. Congress is very unhappy with this result. Lindsey Graham, the senator from South Carolina, has been holding a press conference Thursday about a resolution to condemn what the Biden administration is doing. That is an interesting test for Chuck Schumer, who has been trying to walk a tightrope and describing how he remembers listening to the Yom Kippur War reports on the radio and wondering if Israel would exist, but also criticizing Netanyahu. So I think it sets up an interesting dilemma for him in the Senate. And then hopefully a companion measure in the House would be easier to pass with Republicans favoring it. And I do think that would be embarrassing for the president, even if they can't physically get the arms to Israel themselves, because the executive does have a lot of latitude there. It would be, I still think, a useful exercise for Congress to put its displeasure on the record and force the president to pay at least some price for this embargo he's rolled out.
All right, let's turn to the attempted and failed coup by Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Georgia representative offering a motion to vacate the House speakership. She brought it, notwithstanding long discussions with Mike Johnson, who came away from those meetings thinking she would not do so. She did, without telling Johnson, according to the speaker, that she was going to do it. She got 11 Republican votes. Three more than Republicans have voted to depose Kevin McCarthy last year, but this time the Democrats saved Johnson's speakerships. Let's listen to the speaker respond.
I appreciate the overwhelming show of confidence by my colleagues to defeat that misguided effort. Here's what I have to do every day, Brian. I have to do my job. I have to do what I know to be right. We advance our conservative policies and principles as far as we can here every single day up the field, in spite of the fact that we have the smallest majority in U.S. history. We can't get 100% of what we want, and sometimes a handful of my colleagues demand that. It's just not possible right now. But we're fighting. We're going to get this job done. And I think that's leadership.
The final vote, 359, voting to table the motion to vacate, that is kill it, 43 voting to sustain it, 11 Republicans, 32 Democrats. Kate, is this over for now?
For now, but the issue at stake is that Marjorie Greene could simply decide to bring it up again if she wanted. There was a discussion during the debate over the aid bills for Ukraine and Israel about changing the rule to raise the threshold so that one person couldn't take the entire House hostage at any given point and force one of these votes. But Johnson didn't think he had the support to get that through and did not do it. So now we could watch a repeat of these exercises. And one thing that makes me wary that we could is that former President Trump, when he decided to wade into this, he started his statement by saying, I love Marjorie Greene. She's got spirit. She's got fight, like it was a fight song or something. And that now just isn't the right time for all of this. And so he chose not to cut her loose or to make her pay any price for these antics. And so I think you could see some interest in doing it again and just embarrassing the speaker. I think it's a sad moment for Republicans. And Newt Gingrich a while ago gave an interview where he said, in the 90s, we understood that the Democrats were the opposition. I'm concerned that it's not the prevailing attitude among this corner of the House.
Elliot, no question, one of the most disastrous decisions that Kevin McCarthy made was the deal to allow a single vote motion to vacate to get the speakership in January of 2023, essentially made him hostage to any member. Matt Gaetz, the Florida representative, pulled the trigger on that and toppled him. And it means that any member who wants press gaggle around them to raise money by pandering to those people who are frustrated at the grassroots and send a check, you can do that. And that's no way to govern, and it's become impossible to do so. I think this may come back in the fall when the Congress is trying to negotiate a budget, because if you're going to pass anything, any kind of budget, you're going to have to compromise if you're the Speaker of the House, because you don't have the votes otherwise. You don't control the Senate. You don't control the White House. And you barely control the House.
There's no other way to look at it, I think. I mean, if you want to get something done when you have the smallest majority ever, you're going to have to compromise a little. The problem is there are many people who have an incentive to pretend otherwise, to be able to say, I would get everything I would want if only I wasn't being stopped by this sellout, the leader. And the last leader was a sellout too, and that's why we got rid of him. And the leader before that, a sellout.
And the leader before that.
And now we have Mike Johnson was sold as this once-in-a-generation conservative speaker, and it turns out he's facing the same constraints that every speaker faces. I think he's actually doing quite a good job getting things done, but not everyone wants to acknowledge that.
That is for sure. All right, we will leave it at there today. Potomac Watch Podcast is here every day, and we appreciate your patronage and your time and listening, and we'll be back here tomorrow. Same channel. Thanks for listening.
There's a new class of blockbuster drugs. Drugs like Ozempic. They're changing bodies.
And all of a sudden, just the weight starts falling off.
Fortunes.
It just got too expensive.
They're just bank breakers.
And industries.
There was a lot of excitement. There was a lot of skepticism.
The impact of these drugs from business to health is just beginning.
Coming soon from the Journal, $1 trillion Shot. Find it in the Journal feed wherever you get your podcasts.